call to order and convene at this conference on the 30th anniversary of the Employment Act of 1946. Our fundamental purpose is to reassess national economic policies on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Employment Act of 1946. At the time of its passage, it was considered to be the Magna Carta of the American economy. The Employment Act established the responsibility of the federal government to maintain and to adopt a healthy economy for all of our citizens. It may be called the charge of the Employment Act, calling upon the government to adopt and effectuate such policies as to assure maximum employment, production, and income. Now, there have been good years under this Act. The benefits to our citizens that none of us should want to minimize. But in recent years, our economic performance by almost any standard has been less than satisfactory. This national conference will focus on why that has been the case and what we, as a government, as an economy, as a nation, can do about it. This national conference is the culmination of an inquiry into these questions that the Joint Economic Committee began many months ago. We have had a series of regional hearings looking into the difficulties, the challenges of our economy. We have traveled to Chicago, New York, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Boston, Fall River, Massachusetts. We travel to these areas to listen to the people and, of course, to those elected representatives of the people. To listen to them about their economic situation and what the people of these localities felt could and should be done. Now we want to put these elements together here in the nation's capital in this conference to see what can be done to improve our situation, in simple language, to act. Today, we are especially fortunate to have the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller, with us to open this national conference. Although it may not be too well known, let me just state here for the record that our Vice President, amongst his many accomplishments, also has a degree in economics from Dartmouth College. But his exceptional record in public service since then has been one of consistent concern for economic and social progress and a consistent concern about dealing with the problems that afflict and affect our nation. During his 4 terms as governor of New York, he made major strides in improving the health, welfare, and employment of that great state. Vice President Rockefeller has always been a man of creativity, innovation. His leadership and mission for critical choices is but the most recent example. I'm sure this is going to have an important message for us today. I'm very pleased that he has accepted our invitation open this conference, not only because of his amicable public record, not only because of his many qualifications for welcoming him and introducing him, because I consider him a very good friend. Thank you. social bodies of Congress, the Joint Economic Committee, on the 30th anniversary of the legislation which created the Joint the passage of the Employment Act in 1999.
Sure that they are promoting, not hindering, the
attainment of our overall national objectives. We have all been through a difficult period, especially in terms of political turmoil within the United States. But I'm optimistic about the future. We've all been through, with the creativity and imagination of our free people, their scientific and technological abilities, the managerial skills of the great American enterprise system, and the abundant resources within our borders, we can develop the needed new sources of energy, the needed raw materials or substitutes, protect our environment, and at the same time, produce adequate supplies of food. The opportunities are unlimited for cooperation to help other nations achieve comparable goals in a world that grows smaller and more interdependent at all times. This can well prove to be the most exciting moment with the greatest opportunities in the history of civilized man. Confident of our heritage, with faith in the future, we can lead this country and all mankind to new heights of achievement and fulfillment. And ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, I would like to say to Senator Humphrey that he and his committee, in my opinion, hold the key to achieving and realizing these opportunities for our nation, and that I am deeply honored and deeply privileged by the invitation and the opportunity of being here present on this occasion, this historic occasion, and that I wish this committee and all those who come before it and all those who participated in these discussions well, because I think it's going to be a very significant and historic moment in the development of the kind of long-range planning which is essential to the realization of the opportunities for the people of this great nation and the people of the world under the leadership of the greatest free nation that exists in this continent, in this nation, in this world of all. Thank you very much indeed, Senator, and I appreciate your time.
Difficult and critical condition. The members of the Joint Economic Committee
I've indicated earlier, to the nation's major regions. We travel to these areas to take this part of the government out to the people, rather than merely asking for the people to come to Washington. We found that economic conditions in the cities that we visited were generally worse than the national averages. And might I say that economic problems that afflict us today, and therefore in our discussion of these today, will be related to and referred to the problems that afflict our core cities and our metropolitan areas. For example, in New York, Mayor Bean told us that, and I quote, in New York City's 11.9% unemployment rate is expected to increase to 16% in the next 12 to 18 months. In December of 1975, the unemployment rate in Massachusetts was 11.8, well above the national average at that time of 8.3. And the Boston unemployment rate was even worse. It was at 15%, which underscores what I said earlier, the relationship with economic difficulties and urban problems, or urban centers. Chicago's jobless rate was a similarly high, 11.9%, in September of last year. Now these data demonstrate that national economic indicators all too often do not tell us all that we must know. We also heard from several economic experts, such as Dr. Ray Marshall in Atlanta and Dr. Charles Killingsworth in Chicago, whose guidance we normally do not receive. These people, as well as others, convinced me at least that the country has many intelligent people who understand our economic problems and who have constructive suggestions as to what to do about them. We have used such advice to propose changes through the Employment Act of 1946, through the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1976, which Congressman Hawkins and I introduced in the House and Senate just 2 days ago. May I add that we have members of the committee here that are co-sponsors, Senator Javits of New York is a co-sponsor, Congressman Bowling is a co-sponsor, and I'm not sure I believe Congressman Wong is a co-sponsor, and there are others. And it is a basic piece of proposed legislation designed to meet some of the deficiencies in the Employment Act of 1946. But surely the most moving and useful testimony that we heard came from the jobless themselves. I and other members of the committee heard firsthand what it means to be out of work for 6 months, a year, or longer. These were articulate, sensitive, and able people who, despite their skills, had met with a series of rejections in response to their search for a job. And their words tell a poignant story and are worthy of being reported here. Mrs. Annie Pearl Smith, a mother of seven, and an unemployed auto worker, testified in Atlanta, and I quote her, "I want to work. I don't want to be unemployed. I am on welfare, but I would rather be working. I am able to work, and I want my children to realize that they have to work," end quote. Ruth Shaffner, an unemployed worker in Chicago, told us, "I've been unemployed for 1,240 hours. I have been the recipient of only one unemployment compensation check. I want a job. I need a job. I can produce. I am skilled." Now, probably Gregory Roy summed up best the condition of the jobless in his testimony in Boston. He said, "No one likes to hear the words, 'Sorry, we cannot use you.' Government has to be re-educated to the fact," and he went on to say, "here we are, folks. We're out here. We've been looking for work for months and months. We want a job," end of quote. I remember this young man. He was what you might call a white collar worker. They want jobs. I have long believed that to accept enormous numbers of jobless is to accept massive waste of skills, creative energy, and physical effort. The words of these unemployed workers have reinforced in me this sense of age and shame. In addition to the massive waste that accompanies high unemployment, we also learned that various kinds of social trauma result from the high jobless rates as well. In each region, because of the participation of these regional witnesses, This conference will build upon the views that we learned when we met in the various regions of the United States. With these regional meetings and this national conference, the Joint Economic Committee has demonstrated how the federal government can practice human economics. As Lucy Benson, a former national president of the League of Women Voters, said in our Boston hearing, "I believe it is important to talk directly about people and their needs. Far too often people get lost in numbers." End of quote. I believe that the record of the Joint Economic Committee's regional meetings will serve as a guide to the human side of the key economic interviews. Now, I listen to that human side. May I take the privilege of introducing the panel and asking our panel to proceed to the, are there proper locations here now?
Yes.
The first panel is Kenneth Gibson, Mayor of Newark, New Jersey. Mr. Gibson. Where's Mayor Gibson, sir?
Senator.
The mayor, I welcome you.
Thank you.
Very honored to have you. He's representing the United States Conference of Mayors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today as Mayor of the City of Newark, New Jersey, and as Vice President of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. First, I'd like to commend the distinguished Senator and the co-sponsors for the reintroduction of S-50, the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1976. We are indeed pleased with the redraft of this important legislation and are anxious to lend our support to its enactment. The cities of America are struggling to retain the progress that they have achieved over the past decade in meeting the needs of their populations. The prolonged era of economic stagnation which now confronts this nation threatens to erase their hard-fought gains and very directly endangers the viability of urban areas. The impact of joblessness and lost income, human despair, and foregone opportunity has been especially concentrated in cities. The cavalier attitudes of administration officials toward projections of prolonged recession belies a frightening disregard for the enormous social and economic costs of their misguided policies. In order to present constructive alternatives to these policies, the United States Conference of Mayors urges the Congress to develop a positive program for achieving full employment. It is tragic, but we view this as an immediate federal priority. The growing acceptance of previously intolerable levels of unemployment by members of the administration clearly signals danger for America. The young, the minority, the women, and the workers whose jobs have been lost to machines and foreign competition must not be cast aside in a vast junk pile to be fed only with food stamps and supported by welfare. The recently enacted tax reduction compromise goes only part of the way towards giving the economy adequate stimulus to sustain a reasonable recovery. Attempts by the administration to tie tax reductions to tax cuts are void of economic rationality and, according to Congressional Budget Office, would serve to actually depress the economy during 1976. A restructuring of the tax system to remove the distortions caused by inflation and promote private capital formation is necessary in order to restore equity and strengthen the business investment foundation of the economy. The President and the Congress must follow the mandate of the Employment Act of 1946 and aggressive the federal fiscal process to promote full employment objectives. The time is now for this country to adopt a national policy on full employment. The prolonged levels of joblessness that we face must be immediately addressed by the creation of 1 million public service jobs and a program of accelerated public works in depressed areas. The need for these programs is twofold. First, the tax cuts that have been enacted will not have sufficient stimulus to adequately reduce unemployment levels, as I said previously. And second, the large amounts of public investment are needed to provide human services and rebuild the long-neglected economic infrastructures of depressed areas. As an important part of this effort, it is critical that a complete re-examination of federal income transfer programs be conducted. Too often, we see federal programs spending billions to subsidize unemployment when those very same billions could be used to create productive jobs. Americans want the dignity of meaningful work, and not a fat unemployment insurance check. And we in the cities have plenty of work that needs to be done. In addition to the anti-recession measures, an ongoing public service employment effort is needed to combat structural unemployment. Geographical areas of the country and various sectors of the economy that have been hardest hit by previous federal insensitivity and current economic disruption are in desperate need of capital resources to rebuild. Enormous capital investments will be needed over the next decade in both the private and public sectors to support needed growth, to increase productivity levels, to meet the cost of environmental protection, to build and rebuild our transportation systems. We must ensure that these demands are met and that urban areas have the tools that they need to vigorously compete for new development. In order to achieve and sustain the goal of full employment, federal policies in a number of critical areas will have to be developed and coordinated. There's a desperate need for a rational economic plan capable of establishing guiding federal policy. As capital and natural resources become increasingly scarce and federal programs and agencies increasingly numerous, the need for coordinated action targeted to specific goals becomes essential. We can no longer afford to have fiscal policies contradicted. What little energy policies we have canceled out by what little transportation policies we have. These anomalies have caused Americans to lose faith and respect for all levels of government. As elected officials, we recognize that the failure of the federal government to meet its basic responsibilities in protecting the jobs and incomes of America and its growing inability to effectively and efficiently conduct the operations that we have severely shaken, and we have severely shaken confidence in government by these policies. In conclusion, this great nation, which has been beset by mounting economic problems, must vigorously pursue solutions to the problems of unemployment at a time when many seek to reflect on a history of achievements in this, our bicentennial year. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Gibson, we're most grateful to you and the witnesses before.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to send my congratulations to this committee for this creative and innovative approach to the process of public policy making as the National Committee is pleased to be represented. I want to apologize in advance, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and that I have to get the 12:15 plane, and therefore, when I leave, it's not because the discussion is heated, but because I have to get a plane.
We'll let you get out of here.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The 30 years since passage of the Employment Act of 1946 have seen vast changes in our world, significant alterations in the way in which economic problems are viewed, and also the partial confirmation of the fears of the framers of the Employment Act of 1946. Many people believed that the coming of peace might mean a return to breadline, super federal programs of manpower and in economic development, came from the fear of renewed depression, a fear that ate away at the insides of policymakers and workers alike. Now, after 30 years, at least part of that fear has come true. Despite the juggling of official figures, the barrage of optimistic forecasts, and the assurances that the downturn is temporary, our nation today has suffered its highest unemployment levels since the Great Depression, and that suffering took place last year. And despite some marginal improvement in the first months of this year, our nation appears condemned to live with unconscionably high levels of joblessness. Further, this joblessness is not spread equally among our population. It is concentrated on those whose lives are already constricted by poverty, on those whose opportunities are already unequal because of the effects of racial discrimination, and on those whose economic marginality is confirmed and deepened because of our national misplaced priorities. I believe we must understand that this is no passing phenomenon. Every post-war recession has been followed by higher unemployment. Every post-war recession has claimed its permanent victims, people unable to re-enter the productive labor force. And in the course of time, our concepts of what constitutes full employment have changed. Not very long ago, 3% unemployment was the magic number. Then it moved up a notch to 4%, then to 5%. Now every indication points to an acceptance of a range of 6 to 7% as nationally acceptable. It is clear that the rationalizations for accepting high unemployment are without foundation. The administration's budget proposals and its callous plans to cut social services while maintaining high unemployment should not be shared by the Congress. They would only worsen and make permanent what should be just a temporary, tragic chapter in our history. And this is all the more urgent because of the differential impact economic troubles have on those least able to shoulder them. Back in 1946, when this act was passed, black and white unemployment was roughly proportional. Today, black unemployment is more than double that for whites and has been for the past two decades. On social grounds, this reflects a dangerous divisiveness in our society. On economic grounds, it reflects a tremendous waste of human resources. On budgetary grounds, it reflects a gross misallocation of national priorities. For every million unemployed, it costs the federal government some $16 billion in lost taxes and in necessary support payments. Is it not wise to spend on job creation and on manpower training that will bring productive jobs to the unemployed? The National Urban League, through its Labor Education Advancement Program, has spent $22 million since 1967 on counseling, training, and job finding for minority individuals in the construction trade. That was all federal money contracted for by the League with the Department of Labor. Some would say that that was social spending, federal tax dollars diverted to a nonprofit agency for social programs. I say it was not social spending. It was an investment whose return would be regarded with envy by anyone on Wall Street. Just look at what that relatively small amount spread over 9 years yielded. About 16,000 people found jobs through the program. Many of them are now in non-traditional jobs and in construction jobs once barred to blacks. In 1975, those 16,000 persons earned over $131 million in salary. Since 1967, they earned a cumulative $380 million in salary. In 1967, the federal government has received back in taxes on those earnings over $90 million. In 1975 alone, taxes on the program's participants total over $31 million, or $9 million more than the government investment in the entire program over 9 years. All of this is terribly important because the League's LEAP program and other programs can only deal with a very tiny percentage of the huge number of people in need of economic security. It is my contention that the extent of poverty and joblessness in our land is grossly underestimated, and that the nation must be alerted to the real dimensions of the problem. Officially, 7.2 million people are jobless, 1.3 million of them black. But in addition, there were about 5 million people, 1 1/4 of them black, who were no longer counted as part of the labor force, because they were not actively looking for jobs they knew did not exist. Some 3 million people, 600,000 of them black, were working part-time because they could not find the full-time jobs they wanted and needed. And 2 million workers, 400,000 of them black, worked full-time for wages that amounted to less than the official poverty level. And 2/3 of those persons were family heads. So talk of 7 million jobless is fantasy. There are today some 17 million people either unemployed or subemployed. And black people have suffered proportionately greater economic damage. Of the black unemployed, 35% have been out of work for 15 weeks or more, and that represents a rise from 31% in the third quarter of 1975. Of the black unemployed, 21% have been out of work for 27 weeks or more, and that too represents a rise from 18% in the third quarter of 1975. Black female teenage unemployment too is up, from 36.7% in the third quarter of 1975 to 38.2% at year's end. There are, of course, figures applicable. These are, of course, only figures applicable to the officially defined unemployed. And we have already demonstrated how that is an understatement. The overall 12.9% unemployment rate for black people in America, translated, Mr. Chairman, into a 24.6% unofficial rate. One in every four black workers out of work. Such figures impose social as well as economic costs this nation can ill afford. The cold figures on supportive expenditures, loss of tax revenues, loss of potential productivity, and other elements of economic calculation tell only part of the story. There are also hidden social costs and unbearable personal costs as well. One such hidden cost is crime. Earlier this week, the New York Times headlined a page one story, crime rose in richer neighborhoods. This does not mean that rich folk have taken to burglarizing their neighbors. It means that people who are poor, who are out of work, who see no prospects, will find any means to survive, even if it means breaking laws. Another social and economic cost imposed unnecessarily on our society is the inability of our economy to make places for young people, especially black youngsters. In effect, our society has thrown millions of youngsters on the scrap heap. It seems willing to accept crime, supportive expenses, and other economic costs, rather than invest in increasing productive capacity of individuals and the economy. This is a bitter situation, one that may find us reaping a harvest of social discontent and internal class and race divisions that would endanger our nation. What is to be done? I would hope that this distinguished body would go on record in support of a national full employment policy that guarantees a decent job at a decent wage to all Americans able to work. I envision a three-pronged program to achieve this goal. It would include, one, incentives to private industry to recruit, train, and hire the jobs. Two, would be for the federal government to create a public works program along the lines of the old WPA that helped sustain millions during the Depression of the 1930s. And finally, a vastly expanded public service employment program that would help fill the pressing need for public services while assuring employment opportunities for millions of people. A national full employment policy along the lines I have outlined here would make unemployment a thing of the past, turn revenue consumers into producers, generate tax income to pay for itself, and remove the curse of joblessness from the land. It is my hope, Mr. Chairman, that the Joint Committee can help move the Congress and the administration toward the adoption of these proposals. Thank you very much.
We're very grateful to you, George, for your statement,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, distinguished panelists and guests, I am Bishop James Rausch, the General Secretary of the United States Catholic Conference, the Chief Administrative Officer of the National Level Action Agency of the Roman Catholic Bishops of the United States. I am pleased and honored to have the opportunity to participate in this historic and innovative conference on full employment. I intend this morning to only summarize the lengthier statement that has been prepared for the committee that I ask be placed in the record. My brief reflections. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My brief reflections this morning are based on a major policy statement, a statement on economic issues passed unanimously by the Catholic bishops of this country last November. I have made copies of this statement available to the committee as well, and I presume those will also appear in the record. My comments today will not focus on the technical workings of the economy or detailed remedies for relief of economic distress. Rather, I wish to discuss the human, social, and even the moral dimensions of economic life, what economic forces mean for families and for individuals. We cannot forget that the economic interaction of labor, industry, and government has concrete implications far beyond the marketplace, the boardroom, the halls of government, and the stock exchanges. Behind the jumble of statistics and the rise and fall of economic indicators lie human lives and oftentimes individual tragedies. Speaking from my own particular religious perspective, I am relying on a long tradition of teaching and concern for economic justice and human dignity. We believe that economic policy must reflect broad values of social justice and human rights. In our November statement, the bishops drew on traditional Catholic social teaching principles of economic life. I wish to share several of them with you. First, economic activity should be governed by justice and be carried out within the limits of morality. It must serve people's needs. Second, the right to have a share of earthly goods sufficient for oneself and one's family belongs to everyone. Economic prosperity is to be assessed not so much from the sum total of goods and wealth possessed by the nation, as from the distribution of goods among the people, according to norms of justice. Fourth, opportunities to work must be provided for those who are able and willing to work. Every person has a right to useful employment. Every person has a right to just wages and to adequate assistance in case of real need. Fifth, economic development must not be left to the sole judgment of a few persons or groups possessing excessive economic power, or to the political community alone. On the contrary, at every level, the largest possible number of people should have an active share in directing that development. And sixth, a just and equitable system of taxation requires assessment according to ability to pay. A related and controversial matter is the appropriate role of government in the economic life of its citizens. In their recent statement, the bishop said, and I quote, "Government must play a role in the economic activity of its citizens. Indeed, it should promote a suitable manner the production of a sufficient supply of material goods. Moreover, it should safeguard the rights of all citizens and help them find opportunities for employment." Government has the responsibility of coordinating, regulating, and complementing our free market system. It should operate in those areas where private enterprise is unable or unwilling to do so, or where the nature of the problems require public participation. In addition, government policy... In addition, government policies should promote full employment, production, and purchasing power. As these comments make clear, it is our view that the formulation and implementation of economic policy cannot be left solely to technicians, interest groups, or market forces. Our economic life is governed by its own laws and realities, yet it must be the aim of private economic activity and public policy to so direct and manage economic forces so that the public welfare will be served. Our economic policy must fundamentally serve the public interest, the common good, and the needs of people. That is why broad public debate and dialogue over economic policy is essential, and it is why this conference and the hearings that preceded it are so important. Despite recent gains in employment, official measures of joblessness indicate that some form of unemployment presently afflicts more than 11 million Americans. In 1975, almost one-third of the American people were touched by the reality of joblessness within their family. While we pray that the recovery we now experience will grow in strength and intensity, the recent improvement in unemployment levels represents only relative progress. The fact that more than 10 million Americans are unemployed, far from being an encouraging sign, is only a further indication of the depth and damage of the worst recession since the 30s. It cannot be a cause for rejoicing, nor an excuse for inaction. I wish now to discuss the tremendous human and social costs of long-term unemployment. The experience of prolonged joblessness dramatically affects a person's perception of self and his or her hopes for the future. It cannot fail to influence personal attitudes and behavior in society. Although we do not believe that a person's worth and value is determined by his or her economic productivity, in our culture, persons without employment lose a critical measure of their place in society and a source of individual fulfillment. They perceive that society has no productive role for them, or that there is no contribution they can make. And as a result, alienation and loss of confidence intensifies and leads to increased anxiety and oftentimes to antisocial behavior. Dr. Harvey Brenner, who is one of the discussants here today, has thoroughly documented the direct and startling relationship between economic distress and increased mental illness, cardiovascular disease, and prenatal deaths. We also know that high levels of unemployment frequently lead to greater alcoholism, drug abuse, child abuse, and crime. High employment also contributes to rising social and racial tensions. In a situation of job scarcity, one individual or group can obtain and keep employment only at the expense of another. Threatened by loss of a livelihood, workers too often look for scapegoats and may blame minorities, aliens, women, or young people, with serious consequences to intergroup relationships. Of special concern to us is the negative impact of the loss of income and employment on personal and family relationships. It can destroy hopes and dreams. It can erode family life, interfere with the healthy rearing of children, and greatly increase feelings of insecurity and inadequacy. It can result in the loss of the home itself. It places intense strains on family and community life. In short, long-term unemployment threatens basic human dignity and lowers the quality of life for all those affected. There is also a spiritual aspect to this issue. What happens to a nation that begins to accept the notion that it cannot use the talents and labor of all of its people? What happens to us as a people as we watch families which have made the slow and painful climb up the economic ladder only to be pushed down once again into poverty and dependence by the loss of a job? As a society, can we accept the notion that some will have jobs and income, while others will be told to wait a few years and to subsist on welfare in the interim? What does it mean when our leaders say that there is no way in the foreseeable future to harness the idleness of so many for work on vital social needs such as housing and transportation? It seems to me that these questions pose profound issues of national purpose and identity. It is our position that the current levels of unemployment are unacceptable, and these human, social, and spiritual costs are intolerable. As the Catholic bishops declared last November, fundamentally, our nation must provide jobs for those who can and should work, and a decent income for those who cannot. An effective national commitment to full employment is needed to protect the basic human right to useful employment, which is a right for all Americans. It ought to guarantee through appropriate mechanisms that no one seeking work would be denied an opportunity to earn a livelihood. Full employment is the foundation of a just economic system. It should not be sacrificed for other political and economic gains. Just 4 days ago, we testified in basic support for H.R. 50, the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1976, and we expressed the view that it provides the most comprehensive and useful approach to full employment now before the Congress. We believe this legislation, as it continues to be refined and improved, will provide through its comprehensive planning process and job creation programs a workable and practical way to achieve full employment. By stimulating the private sector and providing for federal job reservoirs, It will ensure that no one will be denied an opportunity to earn a livelihood. We support public service jobs for persons who are unable to obtain employment within the private sector. We specifically reject claims that work within the public sector is necessarily less productive or less efficient or less useful than employment in the private sector. We cannot accept the notion that a nurse's aide in a general hospital or a public service employee rehabilitating homes in our cities is somehow less productive or contributes less than those in the private sector who sell products or work in a factory. Clearly, the vast majority of our people will and should be employed in the private sector, and the major focus of economic policy ought to be efforts to stimulate and increase private employment. However, we should not exclude the essential role of public employment at times of major joblessness. We believe it is far better to spend funds to create and maintain employment than to require families to subsist on unemployment compensation and other forms of assistance with economic and human consequences which we have described. We are encouraged by the recent decline in the rate of inflation. This trend is welcome, although additional strong measures against inflation must be taken. We urge that policymakers seriously consider of wage and price guidelines involving the articulation of specific wage and price targets and vigorous action to achieve voluntary compliance on the part of business and labor. In addition, greater efforts to increase real competition and oppose monopolistic practices ought to be undertaken to strengthen the competitive forces in our economy. The American bishops oppose efforts to control inflation through high idleness of workers. They said in their recent statement, quote, "There are those who insist that we must tolerate high levels of unemployment for some in order to avoid ruinous inflation for all. Although we are deeply concerned about inflation, we reject such a policy as not grounded in justice. Policymakers should seek and use measures to combat inflation which do not rely on high rates of joblessness. For many of our fellow citizens, the major protection against inflation is a decent job at decent wages. This is an important moment in the economic and political history of our land. As we emerge from the deepest recession since the Depression of the 30s, we face a basic choice concerning national economic and social policy. We can harness the concern and experience of our people to enact fundamental reforms in our economic life, or we can return to old policies and programs which offer little hope of achieving greater social and economic justice. I do not believe we can continue to neglect the realities of poverty, the poor distribution of financial resources and economic power, the inequitable taxation, and high levels of unemployment and subemployment. We call on our national leadership, then, to act boldly, to effect an effective and workable national commitment to full employment, to establish a compassionate and fair system which will guarantee an adequate income to those who are unable to work. In the words of our statement of last November, we ask the private and public sectors to join together to plan and provide better for our future, to promote fairness in taxation, to halt the destructive impact of inflation, and to distribute more evenly the burdens and opportunities of our society. A central question before the nation in this bicentennial year is the economy. Massive unemployment, continuing inflation, and widespread poverty. We believe that this nation has the compassion, wisdom, and resources to meet the basic needs of its people and to harness their talents and energy. Our economy is the richest and strongest in the world. The task before us is to harness that strength and affluence so that all of our people will be served more effectively. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I think we all have the same basic goal.
housing grades. That's at the all of your testimony, and every person of life in the place should have an opportunity.
If I may speak to that from a moral perspective for a moment. We believe that man is created in the image of God, and he manifests that most when he has the opportunity to be creative. If the system deprives him of the opportunity to be creative through productive work, and that's the way we are most creative, then there's something wrong with the system and it needs to be corrected. I think people who want to work must be able to work, and that is not true in our society today.
Therefore, you were saying that really the portion of our peoples that are employed is not significant, not as significant as those who now are classified as in the workforce.
That's right.
Because I think that's an important thing to point out. If we go back to the good times, we find that the so-called good times, as far as statistics are concerned, are in the middle of down. We find that less proportion of the population is actually employed because of the workforce has changed.
Mr. Brown, it seems to me that the real answer to your question ought not to be asked maybe to us, but ought to be asked that portion of the workforce that is not in fact working. That is where the problem is. And the fellow who is not working, his concern is not that the workforce is greater now than at some other time, but the fact that he desires to work, and presently the government, the private sector, the public sector, whatever, is not at this moment providing for him that opportunity. And the follow-up to that is that when people are working and happy with their work, they act better. They do better, they're healthier, they eat better, and consequently the whole society benefits. Therefore, I think that whatever the intentions of the administration are, that there has to be a concentration on those people who are now out of the workforce, but want to get in and cannot because of policies that make that possible.
Well, your question about policies to make that possible, I think there's another. He made this concept about 25% of our employment. Yet probably teenagers and marginal workers are more impacted by first minimum wage levels. It seems to me that the minimum wage laws have always been aimed at providing receipt of a decent wage, not necessarily payment. And it seems that the industries that were labor-intensive, activities that were labor-intensive, have been particularly disadvantaged by those kinds of laws. Therefore, it seems that in our wisdom, we should be able, from a governmental standpoint, be able to some way come up with the evaluation of the contribution of that worker that he receives through the general contribution of the government to our general social consciousness, the difference between his contribution to his activity and what we consider to be a decent wage, so that he does receive. Because when we have labor-intensive activities, whatever they may be, and governmental floors on wages, etc., make it impossible to function in this country, industries move out, or become mechanized.
Basic reason for the standardization as it relates to the difference in receipt of payment, I quite understand that because I think when you work, whether you receive it or you get paid, you in fact get wages, and that's what the game is all about.
Well, the difference is basically the cost.
But it's paid based on the work that is done, I think that is probably.
Seven, maybe
excess of 7% of something that we have to live with in order to resolve the other problems. This is something which I can't describe, you can describe. But I do think that it points out the danger of the growth of this as it continues. Very serious situation. Congressman Bannon and Austin, in the last day, they put out something I thought was very interesting. It made particularly the point that Bishop Rausch had made, and perhaps is worthy of your consideration. He pointed out that the Social Security fund that all of this had to be linked from this recently, which everyone was very worried, and for some reason worried, that had we had unemployment, or should we have unemployment, not in excess of 5%, during the period 1975, the beginning of this year, to 1981, then the Social Security Trust Fund would receive, during that period, an additional $44.2 billion instead of being depleted by an estimated $16.2 billion during that same period. We can see what the effect